this morning is entitled The Two Gods of American Politics. So, somewhat surprisingly, the U.S. Census doesn't have any questions about religion. Now, there are, however, multiple groups who have conducted surveys to narrow in on the sort of approximate percentages of religious groups in the U.S. And in general, these are the ranges found throughout all the different surveys. I'll begin with the largest group, and then I'm going to work my way down. Christianity, just over 70%. Unaffiliated, including atheist, agnostic, somewhere around the 20% mark. Judaism, about 2%. Islam, about 1%. Buddhism, just over 0.5%. And Hinduism comes in pretty close to 0.5%. Then we have a bunch of other ones that are all less than 0.5% of the population. Now, the point of sharing those statistics is to help us recognize that while there are a diverse amount of religions in America, even with multiple reports in recent years showing the decline of Protestant Christianity in America, well, it still remains true that the religion with the strongest amount of influence in America is Christianity. Now, when you listen to some Christians, maybe particularly more the primitive Baptist groups and the evangelical groups, you might be led to believe that Christians are being increasingly marginalized in the U.S. The reality is, of course, that's what's really happening is that there are more conservative and controlling religious take on how lives falls should impact other people's lives has, well, it's begun to slowly unravel. It's not that they're being marginalized as much as it is that they are losing influence. Now, I can see how that might feel to someone like being marginalized. But it's simply just, it just is. And with as much as 70% of people in the U.S. still identifying as Christian, for better or worse, it will likely be quite some time until Christians could rightfully make the claim that they are somehow marginalized. The reality is that Christianity very heavily influences the laws and the social standards of our nation. So much so that in spite of the original founders' intent to have separation of church and state, after all, it's a big part of why we were fleeing when we began our nation, in spite of their attempt to have separation of church and state, we now include God in our pledge of allegiance, as well as on our money. And make no mistake about it, many of the 70-ish% of Americans who are Christian understand that God to be very clearly the Christian God, the one on our money and our pledge. Or as I once heard a person here in the South ignorantly say, we are not one nation under Allah. So, as I was saying, the former ministers in here really appreciate it. So, as I was saying, for better or worse, Christianity very heavily influences the law and social standards of our nation. For most of our history, it was moderate to fundamentalist Christianity influencing these laws and these social standards. But as I already hinted at, that kind of Christianity, as hard as it is to believe at times, is losing its influence. And part of that is the cause of the decrease in the overall Christianity, and part of it is the cause of an increase in the more progressive understanding of Christianity that are seen not only in those who identify as Christians, but also in some of those who identify as spiritual but not religious, which includes those who have no particular formula. This has led many folks to describe it as a difference between being religious and being spiritual, hence the label spiritual, not religious. This increase in the number of people who have an understanding of the teachings of Christianity that is different from the more moderate or fundamentalist understanding, well, it's created more than a bit of divide in an institutional religion. And, by extension, and by the current nature of the government, a divide in the U.S., a divide in its politics. I actually sort of address this divide in institutional religion in one of my question and answer responses to Bishop Spahn's newsletter. The question that I was asked is this: why is Christianity growing in its fundamentalist forms and dying where it tries to engage it in thought in the present world? So this was my response. So the lazy answer here would simply be that fundamentalism is concrete and it's easy in comprehension to the constant question. Oh, it's easy in completion. Sorry, that over. My answer was that the lazy answer here would be to say that fundamentalism is concrete and easy in comparison to the constant questioning and the embracing of mystery that comes along with progressive Christianity. Now, keep in mind, I'm saying that it's lazy. I'm not necessarily saying that it is incomplete. Incorrect is just incomplete. See, for me, a big part of this question, possibly the core of this question, boils down to the concepts of religion and spirituality. Most of the worship that we do in churches, even in contemporary churches, is rooted in what I see as religion. It's somewhat dogmatic, tied to tradition. And hurls praises outwardly towards a divine being, typically a masculine divine being. Its value to practitioners is in its stability, familiarity, and ultimately is also the assurance of God and God's mandates, which offer the gathering the comfort and security that they are the most fortunate among the subjects of and under the protection of this particular God. Not infrequently a religion like that, it encourages its adherents to distance themselves from the world lest they become, well, less special. And not surprisingly, those types of churches are growing, even if at a slower rate than they once were. Who wouldn't find some appreciation for being singled out by a God as a specifically chosen people? After all, that's at the heart of most religions across history. As I see it, the places where Christian churches are on the decline or in the various places where an emphasis has started moving from some dogmatic religion to a more open-minded questioning spirituality. And typically, the spirituality has as one of its core elements the connectedness of all of creation. It suggests a certain equality where no one is more chosen than another. And that theological perspective encourages us to engage with the world in an active and in an intimate way, and frequently to the extent of personal sacrifice. Not surprisingly, that has, well, less appeal to a lot of people. Less appeal to many people than a religion that elevates the place special. I don't see this as pointing to less of a need for spiritual community. Rather, I see it clearly telling us that our spiritual communities, and their century-old and even millennially old perspectives, are in need of a massive, thoughtfully done overhaul if they wish to have relevance with the spiritual past so many are on now, and to provide them with a nurturing environment that doesn't expect them to hold their beliefs and actions in tension with each other. While I not so surprisingly think that answer is very solid response and is grounded in sort of current realities. Only a few days after writing it, I became even more interested in its political implications, right? The political implications. You see, there in my response is the implication that the two groups that I have described have two very different understandings of the God. Now, that combined with my point that Christianity very heavily influences the laws and social standards of our nation sets up what could and most probably would lead to a very schizophrenic nation. In fact, I sure think it does, and I'm not the only one. Let's first look at these two gods that I believe my answer suggests. On the one hand is the moderate fundamentalist God. It's a very top-down, dogmatic, masculine-dominated image of God. Basically, in this way of understanding God, God is the strict father. The idea is that Father not only knows best, but is responsible for doling out punishment when the kids step out of line. Now, the other perspective of God is much more nurturing. This is the God who our Jewish religious ancestors believed we were made in the image of. One who wants to see us all live to our full potential and wants to ensure the basic necessities for everyone. It's the God that I believe Jesus and other great spiritual teachers, leaders and teachers, taught us about, or at least tried to. You're probably beginning to see the political implications that I'm putting in. UC Berkeley professor of linguistics and cognitive science, George Lakoff, calls these two understandings of the parental role of God as strict father and nurturing parent. And he's done what I consider to be some of the most fascinating work on what's behind the U.S. political divide. And one of the key factors are those two different perspectives on the preferred family model. With both our religious and national conceptions being built in part around a framework of family. I mean, like, think of God the Father, child of God, holy and security, family the Father. With both our religious and national conceptions being built in part around the framework of family, I think it is a very enlightening perspective. He says this: the progressing world view is modeled on a nurturant parent family. Briefly, it assumes that the world is basically good and can be made better, and that one must work towards that. Children are born good in this way of seeing things. Parents can help them become better. Nurturing involves empathy and a responsibility to take care of oneself and others for whom we're responsible. And on a larger scale, extended policy calls, such as governmental protection in form of a social safety net and government regulation. Universal education to ensure confidence, ensure fairness. Civil liberties and equal treatment, fairness and freedom. Accountability, derived from trust. Open government from an open community. And the promotion of an economy that benefits all and functions to promote these values, which are traditional progressive values of American politics. Now, the conservative worldview says the strict father model assumes that the world is dangerous and difficult, and the children are born bad and must be made good. The strict father is a moral authority who supports and defends the family, tells his wife what to do, and teaches the kids right and wrong. But the only way to do that is through painful discipline. Physical punishment that by adulthood will become internal discipline. The good people are disciplined people in this way of seeing God. Once grown, the self-reliant, disciplined children are on their own. Those children who remain dependent, who are spoiled, overly willful, or overly dependent, should be forced to undergo further discipline or be substituted for the basic discipline of the outside world. So, project this onto the nation, and you see that the right wing, the good citizens, in their reality are the disciplined ones. Those who've already become wealthy or at least self-reliant, and those who are at least on their way to that. Social programs in that way, meanwhile, they just spoil people by giving them things that they haven't earned and by keeping them dependent. The government is there only to protect the nation, maintain order, administer justice, administer punishment, and to provide for the promotion and orderly conduct of business. Now, in this way, disciplined people become self-reliant. Wealth, then, is a measurement of discipline. Which means taxes beyond the minimum needed for such a government takes away from the good, disciplined people, and rewards those that have not earned it. I'm not saying that I like this breakdown, but it does make a lot of sense. And I believe that it also points to, Christianity's accountability in framing this perspective in the United States. Now, from my perspective, the trick now is to both understand the right wing's perspective and to reframe our language so that we can engage it more carefully and in a language that can be heard by those who might consider the other side. After all, isn't that exactly what a people who believe in a murder for a perfect spirit of God?
Thoughts or questions about today's message that I'd like to share with everyone else. So just raise your hand. Make sure you give your name, and then keep your response as concise and brief as possible. So that's that. Please, yeah.
Well, it's really in a response to love. It's not so much something that's demanded, like God the Father is more of a demanding of obedience and strictness. In the aggressive way to understand it, rather than your parents, it's that even the parent loves you so much, provides answers, and therefore responds to that respect that you do this to the Father, because you now know that they have your best interest. They've taught it over and over again just about how they interact and respond. That's a great question. Yes, right.
And having been raised in a family with very authoritarian religious concepts, and then sort of splitting off from that family, we have what we sort of have lived what we're your message is about, where we've learned to sort of use unconditional how to improve your faith in a broader sense. And I really like what you said in the sermon about the very end of it, about learning to bridge the gap, because people raised in that environment, it's hard, it's fear-based.
Exactly.
It's so hard.
But there are ways, and to utilize the language they use, and even the concept they use of a more hierarchical, masculine dominated, to talk about some of the qualities of what we understand is a truer approach to not just Christianity, but most religions, of love and nurturing and equality.
Right.
And it's hard to do, right. But it's possible.
There comes a simultaneous transition.
You're out.
Being able to interpret and put it back in a way that is...
It's more palatable.
Yes.
Easier on their ears.
Very good.
I'm with you. Great question.
We're reading now, as I mentioned, a couple of us, I had an argument with the authoritarian system. Means that the people don't have to do anything, they just follow what they say.
Exactly.
And I think you also mentioned one of the gods, the third god is greed.
Different kinds of gods.
It seems like greed likes the authoritarian god a lot.
Well, I figured that when I was posting the message, some of you would think that the two are money and power. Those are the two. Are there others? Down front here.
You know, when I first saw your message to them, I thought that we were going to talk about the God of faith and the God of football.
Well, we can do that one day. I'm not sure I got anything bad to say about either one of them. Giant outdoor cathedrals.
Yes.
And Zora. Yes, Mark, thank you for bringing out this very complex dynamic that we have in our culture. Religious underpinnings, even our political. I think it seems like our country is a nation of extremes of attitude. Idealistic on the one hand, like striving for ideals, and then selfish on the other, using our own religious kind of underpinnings to justify that. And yet, I mean, I do agree, yes, we are born good. I believe our souls are good, innately, for sure. However, I also have seen that, and I think this is the patriarchal side, that if people do not develop discipline, which has to become eternal, and that's the problem. If you project it outwardly, it's never going to fully work. But if they don't develop discipline to accomplish and guide their lives and just go for the nurturing things, things can end up being very chaotic and out of whack and self-indulgence. So everything is all commingled in a muddy kind of way.
Yeah. So, I think part of the problem is learning how to talk to them, though. Because to and it's, we all fall trap in this. Calling them, I can't remember the word you used, self-indulgent. Or something like that. What we have to learn is that they don't see it that way. They are selfish. You just call it selfish. They don't see themselves as being selfish. They think that they learn. You know, they've been disciplined. They've done the work. And we have to learn how to communicate in a way that acknowledges that and still comes back to our understanding of fairness and equality. And we've all got to work because I think it's selfish too. But it's hard to break through and go, well, I think it's selfish. They don't. They see it not as selfish, but they see it as I've worked hard for this. I've been disciplined. God blessed me with this. I'm not being selfish. It's hard to realize that we can't break them out of, you know, and that we've got to work on our language to be able to communicate that. Let's go to Vance in the back here.
Thank you, Mark. Now that you said my name, I don't have to introduce myself. I enjoyed your talk very much. What was the name of the author and the book that you were
referring to? I don't have the book name, but I'll look at the name.
We'll let me find out later.
It's from UC Berkeley.
That's all right. We'll get there. Don't worry about that. So my main thought in response to what you had to say was many years ago I heard a report about an interview between a reporter and one of my favorite, one of my heroes, a gentleman named John Muir, who founded the Sierra Club back in the early part of the 20th century. And the reporter concluded his interview by saying, well, Mr. Muir, let me ask you this question. What's the difference between you and John D. Rockefeller? And Muir said, oh, that's easy. I have enough money.
Oh, George Lakoff.
Yeah.
I know the name, but just not as familiar. Other new responses.
Okay. Well, one other thought was that your talk went into social powers in each other. It's still popular. It says that if you are at the top, then you are the best.
Yes. Very naive way of understanding
how much you are. And what's your time?